KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman, and this is Weekday. Why are our bodies the way they are? Being human makes us very different from our relatives, the great apes. We're going to talk more about that with Jesse Baring later this hour. Dozens of people were killed by Egyptian militia over the weekend. That was after dual massive rallies in support of ousted President Mohamed Morsi and in support of the interim government itself. Nobel Peace Prize winner and interim Egyptian Vice President Mohamed al-Baradei tweeted for nonviolence. U.S. officials have called on Egyptians to continue the work they began on democracy 2 years ago when Hosni Mubarak's government was overthrown. U.S. officials say they will continue aid to Egypt. What impact will all of this have on the situation in that country? Financial Times Middle East correspondent Borzu Daragahi joined me earlier today. I asked him to describe the extent of the violence on Saturday.
It was a really horrible incident overnight on Friday, Saturday. What happened was that you had a group of protesters at a permanent protest encampment by the Muslim Brotherhood and its allies demanding the reinstatement of President Mohamed Morsi, who was overthrown on July 3rd in a popularly backed coup d'etat. Some people at this protest encampment apparently tried to extend the rally to another location. And at some point, the security forces started opening fire with tear gas. This went on for like an hour or so. Protesters responded, as they usually do in this part of the world, by breaking up some of the pavement into rocks and started throwing stones back. Now, at some point, probably like around 1 o'clock in the morning on early Saturday morning local time, they started opening fire, first with birdshot and buckshot and pellets, and later on with just gunfire, even automatic weapon fire against these protesters. This went on for 8 hours or so. And in the end, more than 80 people were killed in this violence. This is the single worst day of violence in Egypt since Hosni Mubarak was overthrown in February 2011. It was a very, very stunning moment for Egypt. Also stunning because many of the people who supported the coup were kind of dismissive of the violence, and they basically blame the victims for instigating this violence in a rather shocking development and a illustration of how polarized the country has become. Now what you have is the international community basically seeing this for what it is, a drift towards even deeper civil conflict or even potentially civil war at some point. And they have dispatched Catherine Ashton, the chief of the EU, with, as I understand it, the blessing of the United Nations, as well, very likely, the input of Secretary of State John Kerry to come here today and try to mediate some kind of initiative, some kind of compromise between the two camps. But it remains to be seen whether she'll be able to do anything. She was here 2 weeks ago similarly walking away with nothing.
You mentioned security forces, and I'm wondering who these forces are specifically and why people are so concerned about the rise of this particular group.
Well, you know, in Arab countries, you don't have your like friendly, it's not like Officer Friendly down the street doing his foot patrols with a whistle and helping little girls get their cats out of trees. The Ministry of Interior in countries like Egypt has historically been as ominous as the word Ministry of Interior sounds. These are vast bureaucracies filled in many cases with thugs, with very brutal people who specialize in torture, crowd control, interrogation, and so on. If listeners recall, police brutality was one of the reasons why Egyptians went out into the streets in the first place on the 25th of January 2011 and rose up against Hosni Mubarak. And for the past 2.5 years, because of the various political circumstances and because of the volatility of the public, the Interior Ministry has somewhat curtailed its role and curtailed its abuses, at least as far as it goes when it concerns political and other types of activists. But now you have this real worry, not just because of what's happened over the last few days, but because of some of the things that the Interior Minister has said over the last few days, that this same dark force is reemerging in a similar role that it had under Mubarak.
You mentioned that some of the supporters of earlier supporters of the military in deposing Morsi were now maybe splintering away from the group that has supported the interim government. Is that correct?
Yeah, I thought this would be inevitable. The unwieldy coalition of people who supported the coup against Morsi included liberals, leftists, nationalists of various stripes, people connected to the corrupt judiciary and the corrupt Ministry of Interior, and supporters of Hosni Mubarak's regime. This was a very unwieldy coalition, and as long as they were opposing President Mohamed Morsi, they were united. But as soon as that regime came down, the cracks started to appear. And what you saw this weekend was you saw some people who very wholeheartedly supported the coup against Mohamed Morsi start to have second thoughts about some of the players that they've empowered over the last few weeks. And this came out it was very evident in the reaction and the diverging reactions between the various groups over this massacre early Saturday morning, with many people who were what we call here filul, or remnants of the former regime, very much supporting the crackdown and blaming the Muslim Brotherhood for dying in protests, while more liberal and leftist people looking at the actions of the Interior Ministry started to howl that this was not the way they had envisioned things.
Does that mean that some of those liberals and leftists are now joining forces with Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamists?
You know, that hasn't happened yet. I wouldn't be surprised if it happens in a few months. And right now, things are so polarized into these two camps that it's very hard to find any common ground. And even myself, when I write a story, I inevitably get lots of insults from both sides saying that, you know, you're on this side or that side. And my common response to a lot of these folks is like, you know, cool down a bit, but let's talk in a few months and let's see if you still feel as passionately as you do about the position that you're taking.
What does all of this mean, this weekend activity, mean for that interim government? I know that Acting Vice President Al-Baradei sent out a tweet calling also for peace and not violence. Is that government going to splinter?
I mean, I don't know if it'll splinter. Many people have described Mohamed Al-Baradei as a sort of as a guy who's providing after-sales service for the coup. He's essentially trying to sell what has happened here to the international community. He's like the smiley face on the overthrow of an elected government. You know, he's doing his job by appearing to be a liberal and condemning the horrific massacre that took place here. So he would totally lose credibility if he didn't come out against this violence. But it remains to be seen whether he has any power. And there are many questions as to whether the current authorities, who are basically the armed forces and a sort of very weak interim government that they've put into place, whether the armed forces really even need someone like Al-Baradei to give them any kind of political cover at this point, and whether they could basically just scuttle him and will at some point.
So you mentioned now the internationalists are coming, the overseas folks, the EU. You and I have spoken before about the fact that whatever the U.S. says is held in contempt by both sides of this very divisive situation. So what does it mean for the world's governments and representatives of the world's governments to weigh in on this, if anything?
Well, I think that the judging by the frenetic activity of the foreign ministry at this point, they do care somewhat what the international community thinks. They don't want to become an isolated backwater. They are concerned that, for example, many countries in the world consider what happened here a coup, and they are trying to lobby various countries not to regard it as such. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the international community has a lot of power over what can take place here and has a lot of leverage, because at this point, Egypt has gone so far off of the rails on a certain level that I don't think that they're going to be able to put a lot of pressure to get them back into any kind of framework that the international community would consider legitimate.
I'm wondering now, the violence on Saturday, your time, was so horrific. Everybody noticed the extent of what it meant, in addition to people losing, more than 80 people losing their lives. It was a very symbolic moment. Do you anticipate violence to increase? Is it going to die down, at least in the interim?
There's really no sign that the violence will die down in the interim or otherwise. I don't see any, if there is any sign. If you look at, you know, past coup d'etats, there's always been a violent crackdown afterward, sometimes lasting, you know, 10, 20, 30 years. Look at Chile. Is a good example, the many coups in Latin America. So I don't think that there's going to be any kind of, unless something very dramatic happens, I don't think there's going to be any kind of let up on the violence.
Borzu, thank you for taking time to talk to me again. I really appreciate it, and I hope that you're safe.
Thank you so much.
Borzu Dargahi is Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times. He joined me earlier today from Cairo. Egyptian-American Maha Jashan lives in Seattle, where she works as an organizer for the immigration rights group One America, and she's been writing about the crisis in Egypt. She joins me in the studio today. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Do you still have family in Egypt?
I have close family, friends, distant relatives, yes.
So how do you keep in touch with events that are unfolding in hourly? I was going to say daily, but things are changing hourly.
Yes, hourly. My life pretty much consists of checking my Twitter feed obsessively, texting, calling my family and friends, watching Arabic news channels, just any resource I can get. And what's amazing about Twitter for me, I'm not saying it has all the answers, but there are tweets on there that I trust their judgment, that I, you know, look to the resources or the sources that they point me to, and I look through that to make, you know, and I read everything to come up with a conclusion. And honestly, at the point we are in Egypt, anyone who says they know what's happening doesn't really know what's happening. So that's the point of view I'm coming in from.
Well, we were listening to Borzu Dargahi, who we've been checking in with on a regular basis, and you know, he's been covering it, and it sounds from his point of view that what we have is a situation, as you just mentioned, it's hard to know what's happening because there are so many, mm-hmm. not only changes, but different attitudes towards mm-hmm. it. So from all that you've gleaned from the tweets that you follow, from phone calls that you've made, do you feel that he's characterizing what's happening correctly?
Yes and no. I think he is coming at it from the point of view of a Western analyst who is looking at it and they're defining it with certain words. And I think what's happening in Egypt is it's such a new process for us. It's an uncharted course. So there is almost no certain vocabulary that we can classify and say it's a coup or it's not a coup or what it is exactly. But there are three different camps, I feel, of people. There are people who are against what happened completely and they are denouncing it. There are people who are very happy and very excited and they have new hope. And there's people who, I would say I'm part of that crowd, who are apprehensive. They understand that what happened had to happen because we have to realize that these events didn't happen in a vacuum. The media seems like it only focuses on Egypt when there's a protest or when there's violence, which we denounce, obviously, all human blood is precious. But over the past year of Morsi's reign, there has been a lot of violations that he's done, starting with the constitutional decree he did in November, where he gave himself absolute power. Minorities were being targeted. There was lack of freedom of speech. So all of that led up. So what happened on June 30th was leading up. People saw the handwriting on the wall, so to say. Now, was this the best way it could have happened? No, we would have liked to not have the military be involved. But unfortunately, what happened is that the military becoming involved the way it did stop bloodshed. There is more bloodshed, and both sides have to be held accountable, and everybody has to realize, you know, they have to own up to the violence, both the Muslim Brotherhood leadership, who need to pull back their protesters because they understand they are in a position of danger, because some of them are armed. It's not that not all of them are, but there are arms in there. And also at the same time, you have the security forces that he mentioned. You have the police, who are pretty much, they're known for their brutality, and they are not controlled by the military or anybody. They are kind of almost their own force, and they hit back pretty hard when you attack one of their own.
Now, Maha, I know that you're an American citizen. Mm-hmm. You moved here when you were 8 years old. How big is the expat Egyptian community in the Pacific Northwest or even the Seattle area?
You know, I wish we had a census exactly for it, but I would say roughly around 2,000 to 5,000. There is I'm familiar more with the Coptic community that I am part of, and we have three churches here, and we have around 2,000 members. But we also have, there's a huge Egyptian Muslim community as well. So I would say around 2,000 to 5,000.
So are the sentiments, you talked about the three camps, are those three camps represented in the expat community itself?
I would say yes, very much so.
So how, you use the terms we and us when you talk mm-hmm. about a country that you haven't lived in mm-hmm. for, you know, more than a decade, I would say. Uh-huh. I can't say exactly how old you are, and uh-huh. I'm not going to ask you to do that. But
thank you.
did you vote? Do your relatives vote? I mean, what kind of power do you have in Egypt as a citizen living in the United States?
Personally, myself, my Egyptian identity is one that I chose. I do not have an Egyptian passport, neither does my family. I cannot vote in the upcoming elections, but a lot of my friends that are here have either recently moved, or they, as long as they have an Egyptian passport, they can vote. So to me, I come from a unique perspective where I chose this identity. I might not be able to, you know, put my vote in, but I do care about what's happening. And when I say we, I do feel a huge part of my identity is connected to that country.
So do you have optimism when it comes to thinking about a democratic future for Egypt?
You know, I tend to be an idealist, and I believe in hope. So yeah, I do see I see hope, but unfortunately, the short term, it's bleak. But if we look at the long term picture overall, the roadmap that's been drafted out by the interim government, if it is followed in the right way, it does bring hope to Egypt. And we have to understand that Egypt was at the brink where it was economically collapsing. The average citizen was having a hard time finding food, finding gas. So there had it had to come to this point. Now, yes, we are going through a period that's hard. There's a lot of violence from both sides. But I do believe that in the long term, Egypt will be better. And we need to just be vigilant about holding all sides accountable and contributing in any way we can.
Last question has to do with the role that both the United States and the other international community members who have taken a strong interest. What role should they play?
As in governments or people?
I think both.
Mm-hmm. I think in the form of governments, I would hope that they look at all sides, consider all sides, and be careful about what they're saying and understanding where the local community is coming from, because they are the ones affected. As for people, for non-Egyptians, I would say, don't rely on cable news. Don't rely on just news articles. Go talk to, there's a lot of Egyptians in Seattle. Go talk to them. Go on Twitter. See, make your own conclusion. Don't let it be given to you. As for Egyptian Americans, I think we have a huge role to play, whether letting people know about what it's really like. Also, we have a role to support, whether it's economically, whether it's offering our expertise. It's an exciting period. It's a hard one, but I think there is a lot of hope there that we just need to focus on during this time.
Oh, Maha Jashan, we're going to talk with you again. Maha Jashan is an Egyptian-American. She lives in Seattle, and she's been writing about what's going on in Egypt. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
What does it mean to be human? A scientific perspective in a minute here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
KUOW and Seattle Art Museum present Future Beauty, 30 Years of Japanese Fashion, featuring garments celebrating the innovation of Japanese designers who helped redefine modern fashion. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
63 degrees and mostly cloudy in Seattle. Forecast calls for sun this afternoon and a high of 72. Support for NPR comes from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, proud sponsor of StoryCorps, preserving history and celebrating American lives. Well, several new state laws have recently gone into effect here in Washington. One of them affects the security of your Facebook account. Hear about several new laws and find out how they affect you 15 minutes from now.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. Being human is very different than being a chimpanzee or a bumblebee or a rat. We think different, we act different, and we look different. Psychological scientist Jesse Baring explores what it means to be human by asking questions that are sometimes outside of the realm of polite conversation. Jesse Baring is the author of The Belief Instinct and former director of the Institute of Cognition and Culture at Queen's University in Belfast. He's contributed writings to The Scientific American, to Slate, New York Times Magazine, many other publications, and his latest book is Why is the Penis Shaped Like That? And Other Reflections on Being Human. Welcome to the studio. Thanks
Good morning,
for coming in.
Katie.
So maybe we'll give a warning, even though we're not going to talk about the penis straight off the bat, we'll give a warning that this is not your typical science book, and if people are driving around with small children and they don't want to talk about some of this stuff, they might want to tune away for a little bit.
Although I will try to use anatomically correct language.
Yes, so if you're trying to teach your children about these, this could be a great opportunity. So we will get to the question that your book is titled after, but I do want to start with another issue altogether that you get at with the book. Is you look at the question of free will. Does free will exist or not? And you say that rather than ask this question, scientists focus on the reasoning behind free will when it comes to moral questions and how that influences social behavior. So can you give us an example of what kinds of questions they're looking at?
Okay, sure. So from a psychological perspective, researchers are not too interested in whether there is or isn't a free will. The more important question from a psychological perspective is, what happens when we think there is no free will? How does it affect our social behavior? And surprisingly, perhaps, when people are given the impression that scientists have basically reached the conclusion that there is no such thing as free will, that everything is determined by lower level factors, physiologically, genetically, evolutionarily, it actually changes people's behavior in a slightly antisocial fashion. People who are told that there's no free will are more likely to cheat at competitive tasks. They're less likely to help people when they're in need. So in the book, I kind of explore the issue of, well, should scientists be shielding the public from, you know, these types of reductionistic explanations if it actually has these meaningful impact, these sort of meaningful effects on how people actually treat each other.
So it's that if people believe that everything, the way they'll act in a social situation has to do with how they're raised and what personality type they are and future experiences. If they find out that they're going to just do what they would have done anyway.
Right. If they feel like they've got no control over their behavior, or other people have no control over their behavior, the take-home message basically is that people behave a little bit more selfishly. Whereas, you know, if you have a more sort of, I don't know if religious is the type of word to use, but if you have a more liberal sort of interpretation of people's freedom to make decisions at any given moment, we tend to behave more altruistically.
That's interesting. And one of the examples that you use in the book, too, is looking at a childhood Hitler. And
right.
If you were able to go back in time, I guess, is this a question that scientists asked? If you were able to go back in time?
No, that was just something that I sort of explored in the book. But
I like it.
But, you know, it's so the question is, you know, if you were a time-traveling scientist and you can go back to 1894 in Germany and you came across a kindergarten Hitler just playing in a sandbox, what would you do? Would you, you know, somehow try to talk to his parents and encourage his parents that he's, you know, he's, you know, you're coming from the future, you know what's going to happen, and they need to somehow raise him differently, give him information about the Jews or something like that? Or do you actually, you know, do you kill him? killing one 5-year-old child could save millions of lives. And the way that you answer that question is particularly revealing, because if you decide to strangle him, basically, or to kill him, which, you know, personally, I think I probably would do. And I wrote that chapter right after visiting Auschwitz, so that probably impacts my decision. If you do decide to kill him, that probably suggests that you have an essentialist philosophy, that you believe that something sort of inherently evil about Hitler, that he could have at any given time changed his mind about sort of the final solution of killing the Jews. But if you decide to, you know, show his parents some archival footage from the future of the Holocaust, in the hopes that somehow that would upset them enough that they would raise him differently, then you're a determinist. And, you know, it's not... It doesn't tell us anything about – it tells us more about sort of how we think about free will than it does about there actually being a free will.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things you also talk about in the book is you do a few chapters on suicide. And suicide, you would think, would be the ultimate act of free will, perhaps, if free will exists. But in one of the chapters, you're looking at how suicide could actually be an adaptive behavior. So what does that mean?
Right. So there was a guy, a scientist named Denis de Catanzaro, who in the 1980s postulated a fairly controversial evolutionary argument that suicidal behavior in human beings can, in certain situations or in certain contexts, actually be biologically adaptive. And it sounds so counterintuitive on the surface because, I mean, I think most people's sort of common sense view of evolution is that, you know, you need to survive to reproduce. So if you kill yourself, you're removing yourself from the reproductive game. But from an evolutionary biological perspective, it's not so much whether you have children yourself or whether you live to be, you know, 80 or 90 years old. The more important question is whether it's basically the percentage of your genetic material that is propagated from one generation to the next. So the Catanzaro's argument basically is that sometimes killing yourself basically actually increases your net genetic fitness gains, because if you are a burden to your biological kin, or you perceive yourself to be a burden to your biological kin, and you kill yourself, and that somehow frees or shores up reproductive opportunities for them, or somehow gives them a genetic advantage, then there would be some conditions in the ancestral past where suicide would have been adaptive. Of course, this is from the sort of very, you know, cold heart of natural selection from evolutionary theory. Mm-hmm. You know, Mother Nature doesn't care one way or the other about individual humans and their psychological well-being, whether they're suffering or not. There are lots of very negative things like violence and shame and guilt that are actually biologically adaptive traits, in the sense of somehow favoring genetic fitness, but they're painful from just being a human being.
When you were looking at this, did you look at all into the suicidal patterns of human beings today versus what our ancestors would have done?
Right. So that was a big question that I had, actually, and I talked to him about this. You know, right now, you know, today we have all sorts of opportunities to kill ourselves, and that's one of the reasons I actually don't keep a gun in my house. I'm not suicidal, but you know, there are certain. I've actually experienced these types of really intense emotions, you know, in my adolescence and my early adulthood, and I don't keep a gun in my house because, I mean, really, it's just a matter of, you know, pulling a trigger just a millimeter of an inch to completely lose all consciousness, and when you're in a suicidal frame of mind, that is the goal. It's basically to escape the self. And of course, our ancestors didn't have those types of opportunities in the ancestral past. You know, they were sort of limited, I guess, in the ways that they could kill themselves. They could, you know, jump off a cliff. They could, you know, sacrifice themselves to some type of, you know, predator. They could get a cut and let it lead to an infection. You know, they could drown. Well, you know, maybe there were more opportunities for them than I thought. But you know, the interesting thing is that we seem to be the only species that engages in a deliberate act of suicide. You don't find chimpanzees, for example, climbing up the highest tree and jumping or drowning themselves. There are cases where they sort of let themselves die because of grief. You know, they might be mourning the loss of, you know, Jane Goodall had a famous case where, you know, a very young chimpanzee lost its mother, and it was mourning and it was in grief and it stopped eating and it eventually died. But that's very different than us sort of actively, deliberately killing ourselves. And what I think underlies that unique human capacity is our preoccupation with how other people are evaluating us, these sort of social evaluative emotions, this intense feeling of shame and guilt. And the reason I got into these questions about suicide actually is because there was a sort of rash a couple of years ago of gay teenagers that were committing suicide, which really kind of got to me actually as a scientist and as a writer, because I'm gay myself and I remember feeling those types of emotions and that sort of intense shame of being inherently bad and being flawed and wanting to kill myself. And looking at the, you know, all these really, you know, detailed, interesting theoretical models of what motivates somebody to commit suicide was very helpful to me.
Helpful to you in processing what you had gone through as a younger man?
In processing what I had gone through, you know, as an evolutionary theorist, I think there was a point at which evolutionary explanations of human behavior were somewhat, you know, revelatory to me. They were biblical in the sense of, you know, really sort of making sense and understanding human behavior and sociology and psychology. I guess it would be analogous to what other people experience when they're having some sort of religious conversion. When I first started, you know, digging into the literature of evolutionary psychology and the natural origins, the natural history of human behavior, that really changed me fundamentally. It really changed my perspective of who I am and who other people were.
That's Jesse Baring. He's the author of the new book, Why is the Penis Shaped Like That? And Other Reflections on Being Human. I know I don't want to take you through all the stages that a brain goes through right now on the radio, but when you were looking at the different stages of where a mind goes when it's heading down a suicidal route, is there a particular stage or stages that you found the most interesting?
Yeah, so I'll be talking at Seattle Town Hall tonight about what it feels like to be suicidal, really sort of entering the mind state of somebody who wants to kill themselves, and you know it's very difficult to stop them once they reach a certain point. And I'll be articulating a model by the social psychologist Roy Baumeister from Florida State University, who I think really sort of painted a very convincing, sort of persuasive and frightening picture of what it feels like to actually be suicidal. And the reason I really wanted to communicate this and to write about it in detail is because I think that the more that we understand other people and ourselves when we sort of enter these different stages of the suicidal ideation process, the better poised we are to actually intervene and stop that from happening. So he has six stages basically that are progressive that ultimately lead to the final stage. The sixth stage is disinhibition, where you actually, you know, you kill yourself. There are lots of cognitive psychological processes in before that happens that, I think that many of us have experienced. They just simply haven't gotten to the final stage of suicidal ideation. And one stage, I suppose, that really sort of stood out to me and my personal experiences would be sort of a focus on the immediate presence, the immediate present, and trying to preoccupy myself with very concrete details. I was probably experiencing these types of emotions when I was, 19, 20, something along those lines. And I remember being a college student and spending a lot of time studying, you know, really sort of becoming absorbed in my schoolwork and trying to read as much as possible. And reading, you know, and I would read absolutely everything. And the reason I was reading was just basically to sort of cover my own thoughts, to put a cloak over my obsessive compulsive ruminations of what I was worried about, all this sort of anxiety that I had about what was going to happen. And by basically replacing my thoughts with another author's thoughts, that allowed me to escape that sort of really discomforting, unpleasant sense of this, you know, this burden of worrying. I saw myself in that stage, mm-hmm. the sort of this focus on the very concrete present, and, you know, trying to do whatever you possibly can to escape the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure that equals people who listen to the radio in some cases too. So
yeah, unfortunately. So, and I got a lot of emails and, you know, correspondence from people that saw themselves in these stages and, you know, I think, like I said, you know, understanding it, I think, is critical and imperative to stopping it, to sort of being aware of what's happening to you and pulling away from it.
There was one other interesting part in this section that you talked about, the difference between a fake suicide note and a real one.
Right.
What is the difference?
Okay, so again, this is like the concrete focus. So people, so there are some, you know, clever social psychology experiments where basically the participant was tasked with the problem of trying to decipher a genuine suicide note, somebody who's actually killed themselves, versus a fake suicide note. And the fake suicide notes were, you know, basically written by other undergraduate students at a university. They were told, okay, write a suicide note as though you were about to kill yourself. It's actually quite dark. but you know, the question was, is there something happening psychologically between sort of a genuinely suicidal mind versus somebody who's just pretending to be suicidal? So they were able to do that. And the key difference was that the people who were sincerely suicidal, that actually did commit suicide or attempted suicide, in their notes, they were focusing on very sort of superficial, low-level details. So don't forget to feed the cat. Make sure you pay the gas bill. And they were concentrated on themselves. So they were extraordinarily egocentric in their final words. So they were talking about, you know, everything that they were going through, all the pain that they were experiencing and how they wanted to escape that. Whereas the fake suicide notes were a little bit more abstract. You know, they were talking about how someday you'll understand this. You know, please, you know, this is not about you. You know, they were talking about their family. And I think that's very difficult for people and very painful for people that have had loved ones commit suicide to understand and to appreciate that their loved ones were in a very different type of mental state. So though it seems selfish, you know, they were, and, you know, some might argue that it actually is, they were, you know, locked into an emotional framework that drove them to this without the ability really to sort of take the perspective of who they were hurting and the sort of the long-term implications of their decisions. And, you know, it's the, you know, I think that one major misconception about suicide is that it's a the majority of suicides are driven by sort of an emotional flash flood. You know, it's some really powerful, potent type of emotional storm, you know, maybe just one single event where they feel like it's irrecoverable to go back to the past or something along those lines. That's what drives suicide. It's usually not a philosophical decision, sort of weighing all the pros and cons about, you know, being alive and those types of things. It's more an emotional short-circuiting and an impulsive decision.
Speaking with Jesse Baring, who's a psychological scientist who's contributed writings to Scientific American, Slate, New York Magazine, among many other publications. As a side note on the suicide issue, you wrote just an interesting thought, I thought, from a writer's perspective, is that you wrote that in reality, everything that we write or publish is a suicide note. Everything that you put out in the world is sort of the legacy that you're leaving behind, the record of who you are. And I just thought that that was an interesting thought to think about. And I was wondering, since you are a person who thought something like that, does that alter your behavior or the writing you put in the world?
And I think that, you know, that's a sort of philosophical position that that I've struggled to reach myself. And I mean it. I mean, I really do think, and I'm an atheist, I'm an existentialist. I believe that this is our only life. And there really are, you know, we're going to die anyway. We're going to die, you know, whether it's, you know, 70 years from now or a year from now, where all of us are going to die in a relatively short period of time. And everything we do basically is a legacy, is sort of a reminder to the people that we leave behind about who we were. And, you know, why not just be honest? Why not have frank conversations with other people about what we're experiencing? You know, you mentioned the first book that I wrote, The Belief Instinct, which was, you know, my academic research is all about religion and how people think about God and meaning and the afterlife and those types of things. And as somebody who doesn't believe in God and the afterlife and any sort of inherent meaning to life, I strive to live my life in a way that I that, you know, when I drive by a cemetery, for instance, you see all those gravestones of people that, you know, you just kind of wonder what they wish they said when they were still alive, that, you know, they still had the opportunity to actually communicate to other people. Mm-hmm. And now they don't. You know, this is our only chance to really sort of reach other people and to be honest and to, and you know, basically the question is, why not? Why not just be, and this, you know, this is probably why I write a lot about sex, you know, because I think sex is sort of at the heart of what it means to be human, and people are so sort of skittish and shame prone and squirmish when they're talking about sexuality, and so many things go unsaid. I think, I mean, I really sort of think it's a major sort of, you know, maybe it's the fact that I'm gay and it was more of a central issue in my life than other people, but I do think that sexuality is something that is at the heart of what it means to be human and how other people judge us and evaluate us and those types of things.
Well, your book title is Why is the penis shaped like that and other reflections on being human? And you start the book by issuing an invitation to impropriety. Mm. Being like, it's okay to consider these questions. Do you think people need to be invited to talk about these sorts of things that we would consider not polite conversation?
I think you need to set the tone. I mean, I think that you need to, you know, there, when you're writing about these types of things, there are basically three directions that you can go. You can be, when you're writing about sex, as a writer, you can be cheesy, you could be creepy, or you could be cheeky. And, you know, I like to think that I'm, you know, I try to aim for cheeky as much as possible. Mm-hmm. I don't like there's so much bad sort of humor in writing about sexuality that it's just, you know, just kind of facepalm type of thing. And but also the sort of the creepiness factor and being a man and writing about sex and having an agenda. So, you know, it's really sort of a challenge when you're talking objectively about things like female ejaculation and female orgasm and, you know, the psychopharmacological ingredients of semen, to really sort of have, you know, to really not come across as being, you know, and, you know, probably lots of people think that I am a weirdo, but but everybody's got these things. You know, this is just part of human anatomy and human physiology, and we don't know anything about it. I mean, we know very little about it, at least, and people don't talk about it openly, and I think that people should. I think that we do need an invitation to be inappropriate, but, you know, not inappropriate, but be blunt and get things out on the table. I think it can actually have you know, a significant humanitarian impact.
I left you all of a minute to actually explain the title of this book, which we've been saying the whole time. So I have to ask, why is the human penis shaped like that?
Yeah, now we were talking about that. I'm glad that you didn't lead off with, so why is the penis shaped?
I know. I figured that would be what everyone did.
So. Yes, they have. I'll try to put it in a nutshell, and it's hard to avoid puns. And talk about penis and testicles and those types of things. But the penis is the argument, at least the sort of the dominant evolutionary argument, is that the penis is shaped like that because it is literally a type of tool, and it is designed to retract the semen of competitive males that would have had sex with your female partner within about a 48-hour period of time, which is the lifespan of your average sperm cell. And, you know, they're sort of revealing morphological characteristics of the human penis. And, you know, it looks very different from chimpanzee penises, for example, and mm-hmm. cat penises or whatever. It's got that distinctive sort of glans head, the coronal ridge, which is sort of the umbrella lip underneath the glans head. And the argument is that when you thrust and sort of have vigorous sex with your partner, you are retracting the sperm of somebody that had sex with that woman, you know, within a short period of time before. But there are all sorts of interesting caveats. You know, one is that, you know, you get flaccid pretty much immediately after you ejaculate. And that's good because from an evolutionary perspective, it would be sort of self-defeating if you kept having sex with a woman after you ejaculated because you're removing your own sperm cells at that point. You also fall asleep, you know, this sort of nambulistic effect of actually obtaining orgasm. And when you're separated from your partner for a period of time, you tend to get more sexually aroused upon reunion and have more vigorous sex. And the argument is that, well, that's because you haven't been able to sort of monitor your partner's sexual behavior in your absence, and the likelihood of her, basically in this case, being with another man during that period of time would be increased. So you better you know, you better get that, you know, foreign male semen out of her. That seems a little crass. But anyway, that's the gist of the argument.
Well, and as you say, as you write, that if you feel doubtful about the interpretation of the data, natural selection doesn't care if you favor an alternative explanation.
Lots of critics of evolution psychology, of course, yes. But natural selection doesn't care. It's just as long as your penis does the work. That's all that really matters in the end.
Jesse Baring is the author of the book The Belief Instinct, and his new book, Why is the Penis Shaped Like That? And Other Reflections of Being Human. Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thanks, Katie.
This is Weekday.
Jesse Baring spoke with KUOW's Katie Sewell. And in a minute here, we're going to turn our attention to some new state laws and find out how they affect you. That's just a moment away.
KUOW thanks the members of the Broadcasters Circle for their generosity and leadership support throughout the year. For more information on how you can become a Broadcasters Circle member, visit KUOW.org.
64 degrees in Seattle, mostly cloudy. Expecting sun later today with a high of 72. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:51.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. As we head into August this week, a host of new state laws have gone into effect. Joining us to touch on some of them, Everett Herald political writer Jerry Kornfield. And we couldn't let August come, Jerry, without touching base with you. We've missed you.
Well, I've missed you, but the lawmakers have taken a break from us. They disappear when all the laws take effect. That's how it works.
Well, I'm not sure if that's good or bad. Are there some highlights of what took effect yesterday?
Well, you know, it's interesting this year. There's quite a few bills that became law dealing with alcohol. So as of yesterday, a number of measures, some theaters that cater to 21 and over, and I'm not talking about adult movies, but there are some theaters that just are more for adults, they'll be able to sell alcohol. There's also, if you're into craft distillery spirits, you have been at this point able to go in and buy 2 liters. Well, the new law took effect, you can buy 3 liters, so you can buy more alcohol in that way. Farmers markets are going to have samples of wine and beer. And then, interestingly, in September will be when a new law takes effect that's intended to crack down on those who continually drive drunk and get caught. There'll be longer sentences. They'll have to have those interlock devices on their car. And for some, they'll need to enroll in a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week sobriety program. So the state is dealing with all aspects of, I think, liquor privatization as it hits the communities.
I know that, and also they toughened up the laws against boating under the influence, which maybe doesn't affect people east of the Cascade Mountains, but surely does in the Puget Sound region.
Yes, I mean, again, it's they're looking at where alcohol is involved. Sure, got a lot of attention. So boating is one. They've also looked at, well, it's not alcohol, but marijuana. They're having to look at how to, now that it's going to be legal for adults to smoke pot in their homes, now they don't want them getting behind the wheels and driving or boating. And so all these laws for DUI are also going to have for under the influence of marijuana.
A new law lets people who were wrongfully convicted of a crime file for damages?
Right. And it doesn't happen often, but when it does happen, they would be, and if they can go in and, you know, it happens and they make their case, they could receive up to $50,000 for every year they were locked up behind bars, and another $50,000 on top of that if they were locked up behind bars on death row. So, you know, they've set a structure. It doesn't, like I said, it doesn't happen often, but there's been enough cases, especially with DNA research, that over the years in this state and around the country, that the, I think it was the Innocence Law Project, they kind of brought this forward and has been pushing for it, and they succeeded this year.
Another interesting area is social media. The Senate wrote a bill which passed both houses that has to do with the use of social media in your workplace.
Right. State Senator Steve Hobbs of Lake Stephen, the second year in a row, he prime sponsored this, and it didn't get much attention last year, and it really didn't have much fight against it this year, but they did have to make some changes in the end. A worker or companies were worried that while they were considering employing somebody, they wanted to be able to, you know, if there's an investigation they want going on, they want to be able to at least ask the employee, hey, we want your password. If you don't think you did wrong, you know, let us, you know, help us figure out what you're doing. And so they had to tune it up a little bit at the end. But the bottom line is they just can't go in and say, hey, before we hire you or anything, you know, we want to check all of your social media accounts. They won't be able to do that.
We're talking with Everett Herald political writer Jerry Kornfield, who joined us through the long series of legislative sessions this year. And we're talking about some of the bills that went into effect over the weekend. Gun control was something that lawmakers went to Olympia really eager to get through, and a comprehensive gun control bill did not pass, but a firearm offender registry is in place now, right?
Right. What they created is something that is very similar to what they have for the sex offenders and for kidnappers. They have a database of people who are convicted of these crimes, but unlike, say, the sex offender database, which is open to the public, the firearm offender will not be. What happens is if you get convicted of a felony and you involve a firearm, you could be required to have your name on the database for a period of time. And that will allow cops to, when they come upon you and they want to do a check, if you show up in their database, they'll know that, hey, this person has a history with guns. State Representative Mike Hope of Mill Creek, he's a Seattle police officer, was the prime sponsor of the bill, and he argued that, hey, you know, the cops can use this information when they come up on any call that might help them. And it went through the legislature, unlike the other bills. It went through pretty smoothly.
And finally, something that is of interest to Seattleites who are all up in arms about this, a law has gone into effect that caps how much tow truck companies can charge you when you go retrieve your impounded vehicle.
Yeah, I think the first rule is don't get your car towed.
Right.
Because after that, the prices, even though it has some caps on it, if I recall the debate at the end, it was, they didn't feel that heavy. They didn't feel very capped. I mean, you could charge $270 plus another $60 a day is what I believe the numbers are in the law. But there was some testimony to the fact that you could have your car towed and held for, say, a day or so, and you could be out $700, $800 when all is said and done. And so, you know, that's the lesson to be learned. There's no free lunch or free tow, if you will.
So make sure that when you put your money in the parking meter that you know how long you've got, right?
Yeah, which is you know, there or anywhere. You know, it's interesting. It's the big city, Seattle, has a lot of issues. That's one. And interesting, there's another law, I'll say real quickly, that deals with electric vehicles. They're going to have this problem probably in Seattle. They've now going to have spaces, much like the handicap parking spaces. And if you park in a spot that says for electric vehicles only and yours isn't electric, you're going to get a $124 ticket.
Are they going to tow you too?
With an electric tow truck. But they'll charge you real dollars to get it back.
Oh, goodness. Well, Jerry, thanks for taking a few minutes to touch base with us on some of the new laws that went into effect over the weekend.
Oh, my pleasure.
Jerry Kornfield writes about Olympia and state politics for the Everett Herald, and he's been a regular guest this past winter and summer here on KUOW's Weekday. Our show, produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, and Andy Hurst. Bernard Ouellette, the man at the helm. I'm Marcy Silman. Our gardeners join us tomorrow, as it is Tuesday. We'll be taking your calls and questions. Hope you join us then.
A new survey expedition will be looking at ocean acidification and how it impacts marine life. We'll have more on that in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. How are you planning on voting in the primary election next Tuesday? Is there anything that could still change your mind? If you're still undecided, why? Share your thoughts right now by calling 206-221-3663. 206-221-3663. We're contemplating your choices in this primary election this afternoon at 12:20. It's cloudy in Seattle and 64 degrees forecast.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.